This is The Takeaway for Tuesday, January 24th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry, broadcasting today once again from Oklahoma, KOSU in Oklahoma City to be exact. We've come here to experience a place that is enthusiastic about the next 4 years. For one thing, there's news that President Trump will push forward both the Keystone XL and Dakota Access pipelines. Pipelines that will come directly to Cushing, Oklahoma, a place we will visit in just a moment. Oklahoma's a place where some of the toughest, hardest chapters in American history were lived, from the Dust Bowl to the Great Depression to the boom and bust oil economy that keeps the lights on around the world. These people don't like to be lectured to about the environment. They've been living off the land for generations. They say they know nature's wrath as well as its gifts, and what they mostly know these days is the price of oil.
I'd like to see the price of oil come back up because if you're going to Stillwater and you see all them rigs laying on the ground over there and you think about how many thousand jobs or thousand people are out of work just because them rigs are laying over there, you know, it kind of makes you stop and think.
Bob Noltensmeyer is the city emergency manager in Cushing. It's just north of Oklahoma City, not far from Stillwater, where he was talking about all those abandoned rigs. They measure the economy in oil rigs around here. One of the things most Americans don't know is that for all of Barack Obama's reputation for tackling climate change, the last 8 years have seen America become one of the three biggest oil producers in the world through a combination of federal policies, advanced drilling technologies, and favorable prices. Oil is gushing in Cushing. The city, in fact, is the perfect snapshot of the complexity of U.S. energy policy right now. And you might say Cushing has been literally trembling in its boots.
My husband and I had to hold on to the bedpost. It was so bad.
Another one.
Oh, my gosh.
We had a 5.0 earthquake November the 6th, and it shook things pretty good, and we recovered very well.
That earthquake was huge news around these parts, but Bob Noltensmeyer is a little sensitive talking about it to a couple of strangers from New York City.
There are a lot of tree-huggers running around here blaming the oil and gas industry.
Environmentalists.
Yeah. Okay. The thing of it is, they may have a minute responsibility of this. There's nothing confirmed on it. I used to drive for a service company. We did a lot of fracking, and this has been going on for years. Fracking, injection, and you look at different places around in Texas and North Dakota, South Dakota, that are doing the same thing. They don't have it. The thing of it is, we live on 5 fault lines. That makes a lot of difference.
You can see the earthquake damage in this forlorn little town by just strolling down Main Street. For an earthquake zone, the town of Cushing, Oklahoma, doesn't have a lot of dramatic geology. No canyons here, no big rock formations suggesting the power of the earth underneath. But there's damage. Bricks falling off walls, piles of debris, tattered caution tape. Yep, the ground shook here. And people remember it.
Respecting Bob's opinion, I tend to listen to a lot of different sources of information.
Now, Jeremy Frazier, the assistant city manager in Cushing, will admit that the earthquake has people worried for the first time about aggressive use of fracking and high-pressure water extraction techniques for getting oil.
I can say that, generally speaking, when there are very few of a event and you change something, and then after the fact there are quite a few more of those events, you know, those events being earthquakes in this case, I personally believe that there is some connection. I also believe that the state of Oklahoma would not have reduced the number of injection wells had there not been a connection of some sort.
I've been a friend of the oil industry for years. Like I said, I used to drive for a service company. I know how it works. I know how it operates. I don't think that they're fully totally responsible for it.
But Bob Noltensmeyer was still shaken by that November 6th quake. It was an emergency he doesn't usually think about.
A 5.0 earthquake, I mean, it shook everything, and it did more damage to things than a normal earthquake or tornado or anything would do. It shook a lot of brick loose on different buildings and everything. Luckily, we only had one injury. minor, very minor, and we lucked out very well. Just a lot of shattered nerves.
Shattered nerves and a reminder that the big oil companies in Cushing are prospering, even if this town's bricks are crumbling and the whole community looks like it's seen better days. Assistant City Manager Jeremy Fraser.
The oil companies, with the exception of just a few, are actually located, for the most part, outside of the city limits. And what we find, and at least what I've been told, is that a great portion of those employees actually commute into the community. They work at the oil facilities, and then they commute back home. In terms of the standard of living within the community, while there are some individuals that prosper, the majority of those people do live outside of at least the city limit.
So head outside of town, outside of the city limit, and you see a landscape that looks something like an alien civilization. Sensitivity about environmental regulations and policy is not hard to understand here in Cushing, Oklahoma. On this windy scrubland, the people have bet their livelihood and their lives on fossil fuels. And you can see it just south of Cushing, a huge storage tank facility, the largest in the world, with names like Enbridge, Plains, TEPCO, ConocoPhillips, Sunoco. Together, it holds more than 46 million barrels of oil, capable of setting the price of West Texas crude since 1983. It means oil is everything in this town, and anything that threatens it, threatens everything. Those giant tanks that stretch for miles represent the oil wealth of a continent. And that means Cushing is the linchpin of American energy policy. It actually sets the price of oil. We spent some time with reporter Joe Wirtz of State Impact Oklahoma, who says the way Oklahomans think about the land is not the way environmentalists think about it. Here, you use everything. Farmland, fossil fuels, even the abundant wind in Oklahoma figures into the calculation of prosperity. If it means that fracking and high-pressure water extraction shakes up the earth, so be it. Joe Wirtz says the whole energy game has changed here over the last few decades.
Boy, it sure has. You know, we've been fracking in Oklahoma for decades, but really the combination of the well completion technique known as fracking, which uses high pressure water to crack rock underground, and horizontal drilling, which allows you to drill into these really narrow deposits and unlock oil and gas that we've known has been there but haven't been able to get it out. These two combined resulted in runaway production over the years, in recent years here in Oklahoma and a lot of states.
And runaway production, that means that in the United States today, we don't talk so much about energy independence because the United States has become, because of this technology, one of the biggest producers in the world.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the story these days is about American oil and gas, and that hasn't been the case over the decades throughout the country yet. We're really able to be self-reliant and use a lot of what we make here, and in some cases, ship it out, export it, become producers for the world, and bring American oil to global markets.
And the flat lands of Oklahoma, you know, that's just the surface. But down below, there's a whole rich story, and some of the details of that story of what's happening underneath the earth are coming to the surface. Explain how the underground of Oklahoma is revealing itself in these days of fracking.
Underneath Oklahoma, we do have these vast oil and gas deposits, which are the primary economic driver of Oklahoma. But also underground are these vast quantities of water. These are ancient oceans, right, that have been locked and trapped under layers and layers of rock. This water is, you know, it's toxic. It's super salty. It's got metals and weird salts and underground elements that have infused with it. So when Oklahomans drill for oil and drill for natural gas, they get that water comes up to the surface with it. And the name of the game in the oil business in Oklahoma is to get rid of that water. And the government-approved method of dealing with that toxic water, which you don't want anywhere near drinking water, you don't want it near creeks and rivers and streams or farmers' fields, what you do is you pump it back down where you got it. You pump all that water back underground. And scientists say the pumping of that wastewater, you know, billions of barrels of it a year, is disrupting fault lines and causing earthquakes. We're changing the earth, and the earth is changing.
Now, when I'm driving in Oklahoma and I see wind farms,
right,
is that the sign of some movement away from oil and gas and towards some sort of sustainable solar panel utopia that I haven't heard about?
Well, yeah, Oklahoma is a major wind state, one of the top states in the country for wind power capacity. It's been booming. You know, Oklahoma is obviously synonymous with wind. It's in the song, and it's certainly a big part of the cultural identity for Oklahoma. It's not uncommon to find Oklahomans who are doing three different things, who are making money three different ways. They're a farmer, they're a wind farmer, and they're in the oil and gas business. They look at it as, you know, making money from the land. And if that money comes from cattle, it comes from ranching, great. If it comes from, an oil and gas well, that's fine too. And if it means putting up a wind turbine and making money that way, Oklahomans will, you know, by any means necessary. It's a tough place in a lot of these spots of the state. You have to diversify and look at ways to make money. If you're a rancher and we get into a round of drought, which has happened in recent years, the checks that you get from the wind company might make all the difference in the world.
One of the amazing things here is that what you're talking about is in not too many years, some green energy, environmental hippie kind of person in Tennessee could be getting their wind power from one of the most pro-fossil fuel states in the country, right?
That's right.
Only in America.
Only in America. Only in Oklahoma.
Joe Wirtz, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Joe Wirtz is a reporter with State Impact Oklahoma.
I'd like to ask President Trump.
My question is,
I wonder.
I'd like to ask President Trump.
I would like to ask President Trump.
My question would be.
We want to remind you that over the course of the next 100 days of the brand new Trump administration, The Takeaway and our partner PRI are using the president's preferred method of communication, Twitter, to ask him 100 questions. And we want you to join us. When it comes to healthcare, global security, immigration, foreign policy, education, and domestic issues, what questions should President Trump have to answer? Mady Rodriguez asks on Twitter, Mr. President, what are you going to do with DAPA and DACA? Catherine asks on Twitter if the president is going to ban Muslims or deport illegal immigrant children.
Hey, this is Grant from Charlotte, North Carolina. The one question I want to know is, when are you going to release your taxes? We want to know where the money that you're earning is coming from. I feel like you're hiding something.
Today's question in the 100 Days, 100 Questions project is, President Trump, how do you plan to unite the divided American electorate? Help us by retweeting our question to the president or tweeting your own. Use the hashtag 100 Days, 100 Qs. That's 100 Days, 100 Qs. We'll nominate one question each day that we think the president should answer. Again, today's is, President Trump, how do you plan to unite the divided American electorate? We hope you'll join us in tweeting each day's question, and we'll see if we get a tweet back. If you want answers, share your questions. If you want to find out more about this project, head over to thetakeaway.org. So our trip to Cushing raises the question of, how does someone who looks at land and energy the way a typical Oklahoman does go about running an agency like the Environmental Protection Agency? Scott Pruitt, Donald Trump's nominee for EPA head, is the former Attorney General of Oklahoma, and he's built a reputation for battling the EPA. He sued them several times, challenged regulations on carbon emissions and water pollution. He's been successful in court, and he's worked closely with the fossil fuel industry. And so the question is, can Pruitt make policy, or will he just be a lightning rod for environmentalists? J.D. Strong is the head of the Oklahoma Department of Wildlife Conservation. Strong has worked with Pruitt for the past 6 years. He says Pruitt has an intelligent vision of how to better balance the environment and industry and to get people working together. If, Strong says, Pruitt can control his reputation for being something of a raging bull.
In everything that we've engaged in, several pieces of litigation, whether it be the Chickasaw Choctaw tribal litigation that we resolved or things that we have resolved with the state of Arkansas when it comes to water quality protection, he has always been about common sense, regulation, continue to protect the environment. In both of those cases, for example, we will end up with more stringent environmental requirements when it comes to water protection. It's just about making sure that that is very much state-led, state-driven. driven and that the states are on board with the final decisions at the end of the day.
How much style modification do you think Scott Pruitt needs to engage in to make sure that his changed vision doesn't result in an office where he has no friends?
And I do think he will have some challenges, again, because you have an agency for the past 8 years has been conditioned to operate in a certain fashion, in fact, told to operate in a certain fashion. And I think you can't expect him to go in and overnight change that posture that the agency currently has. But I think he is the right guy. He is very goal-driven. He is very obstinate when he needs to be, when he sees those goals in sight. And I think he will dig in and expect some changes to be made. Because frankly, it'll be hard from the other side as well. As a state regulator, I can tell you that a lot of bridges have been burned when it comes to that relationship between EPA and the agencies that really are charged with implementing those regulations. And so it's going to take some time for, I think, state environmental regulators to see the change and accept the fact that this may actually truly be occurring and we may actually have an opportunity to work in partnership.
Is Flint the example that is an argument to strengthen the EPA as opposed to this is not the time to maybe be weakening the EPA?
I think it could serve as a poster child for why we need to strengthen the relationship between EPA and the state. I think if you look at the example of Flint, you will see that there was a complete breakdown in communication between regulators at the state of Michigan and the EPA, and it's because that relationship between the state and federal government has eroded so poorly over the years that they don't talk to each other. And so it would have been a much better outcome, I think, if the state of Michigan water quality regulators would have been in close communication and coordination with their EPA region as well as EPA headquarters so that they could craft a much better solution that would have protected folks. Here in Oklahoma, we do a fine job at the state level at our Department of Environmental Quality, for example, in ensuring the protection of health, public health, when it comes to drinking water. And that's including the poorest of communities in the state of Oklahoma.
As Attorney General in Oklahoma, Scott Pruitt unquestionably is charged with protecting the prosperity that comes from the oil and gas industry, right?
Well, I think he's charged first and foremost with protecting the prosperity of this state in general, and certainly the oil and gas industry is a big industry and revenue generator in our state.
And it's a revenue generator, and it's something the entire world is dependent on, with the price of West Texas crude being actually set here in Oklahoma.
That's definitely correct, yes.
So how does someone like Scott Pruitt keep that huge influence in balance with other forces in the federal government, other opinions, other ideas, when he's setting out to manage the EPA?
Well, I think lesser people probably couldn't handle the need to keep things in proper balance. But Scott Pruitt, from what I've seen, is not one of those people. I've worked with him for 6 years now and have never once been asked to compromise our environmental integrity, our environmental regulations, anything for the benefit of the oil and gas industry or any other industry in the state of Oklahoma. And so I think he is aware that it is possible to balance. And I think that he's a believer, as I am, in the fact that environmental protection and economic development are not mutually exclusive. They can work hand in hand. And so I think you have to have somebody that knows how to strike that proper balance, to have necessary environmental regulations to protect public health first and foremost, but at the same time ensuring that we have economic prosperity in our state, in our country, because we understand that that also helps us ultimately have a better quality of life just as much as clean air and clean water do.
Finally, the experience of Ann Gorsuch Burford in the Reagan administration, who was an individual put in charge of the EPA that seemed to have a mandate to really defang the EPA, to reduce its authority and to make it ineffective. That didn't work, and that was a conflagration, and people came in and told the president that you got to do something differently. Do you think Scott Pruitt is aware of that situation and doesn't want to repeat it, and that maybe Trump is aware of that situation and doesn't want to repeat it, or are we walking down some of the same trails here?
Well, he's got to be aware. I know if he's nothing else, he is a great student of history, and so probably will have already taken a look at EPA administrations of the past and their trials and errors, or he soon will be getting up to speed on that. But I also know, you know, he had a similar experience when he was elected attorney general 6 years ago. He walked in. It changed from a Democrat to a Republican office where they had an environmental protection unit, and he sort of changed that focus, and he was able to keep some folks on board that were working in the right direction and adopted his philosophy about things. And so I think that we'll see a very similar thing happen over at EPA.
J.D. Strong, thanks so much.
Thank you.
J.D. Strong is the head of the Oklahoma Department of Wildlife Conservation, former director of the Water Resources Board, and former Oklahoma Secretary of the Environment. This week's case in point from our friends at the Marshall Project illustrates how laws to protect prison guards may end up putting inmates in danger. Take the case of Army veteran Elliot Earl Williams, who died on the floor of his cell in the David L. Moss Detention Center in Tulsa, Oklahoma, a slow, agonizing death documented on prison video. Williams was paralyzed with a broken neck. He's just one of many cases of improper treatment at the Tulsa County Detention Center, where at least 20 people have died inside the facility since 2010. Williams' case is finally being heard in court now. The sheriff, Stanley Gantz, has since resigned. Andrew Cohen, commentary editor at the Marshall Project for this week's Case in Point, says it illustrates a lot of the problems in corrections regulations. And Ziva Brandstetter, editor-in-chief of The Frontier, has been closely following this story and helped to bring it to light.
So Elliot Williams was a veteran who had no criminal record. He had a history of PTSD, mental illness, and had a sort of break when his wife became estranged from him. And so he got picked up by the police, transferred down to the Tulsa jail. And he was having a psychotic episode, started ramming his head into the metal door in the jail, and he eventually ended up breaking his neck. Paralysis set in within a period of roughly 24 hours. They moved him to what they call a medical cell. You know, I don't know why they call it that, because there's no actual medical care that was really given to him. And then he spent 5 days laying on the floor. They were tossing trays of food next to him. They were putting cups of water just out of reach. The jailers and the nurses all just decided that he was vaguing, malingering, as they call it. And so the video is basically that time condensed down to about 10 minutes. And it is, as a journalist, I've watched 4 or 5 executions, and this is one of the hardest things, you know, that I've ever seen really on video.
And what's the legal issue here?
Well, the legal issue, the law is designed to protect the status quo, to protect the guard in most circumstances in these close calls. And what you see on the tape and what the litigation that is now sort of hurtling towards trial tells us is that there was this deliberate indifference. That's the legal standard. Deliberate indifference on the part of officials was patent. It was from the moment he got in there and he was disbelieved by medical professionals, the fact that they ignored his pleas for help, to the fact that they didn't ensure that he had hydration. He died, coroner said, not just from his broken neck, but from dehydration. He wasn't being given water. So you add it all up, and it's no surprise that a judge, who, by the way, has been handling other problems of other inmates involved in the jail, said, no, I'm going to allow a jury to hear this. I think this is something that survives the typical pretrial motions that often kick out these cases.
When did you get wind that there was a pattern emanating from this facility, and who has been called to account? Who's actually paid the price for some of these lapses that you've reported?
Well, this is a jail where we've had roughly 20 or so inmate deaths in recent years. We've had episodes where nurses are falsifying, you know, medical records to pass inspections. They've had consultants that they've hired themselves that have come in and said, this is unacceptable medical care. So I'd always heard about the problems in the jail, the deaths in the jail, but it was hard to get your arms around a per capita number. How do you compare it? Is it worse than others? We got done with the sort of law enforcement corruption side of things at the sheriff's office. The sheriff got indicted and removed from office because of a wealthy friend of his that he allowed to sort of play cop, pay for play. And then I started seriously looking at all these outstanding civil rights lawsuits at the jail, and that's when I kind of put things together. One of the things our reporting shows is that the jail had a monitor who was supposed to be, you know, watchdogging their private medical provider, and she had never submitted any reports.
So, Andrew, what is the lesson here as we try to determine what should be the proper relationship between laws that protect correctional employees, laws that provide for a minimum of acceptable health care for inmates, particularly mental health care, and the standard protections of inmates that relate purely to criminality? It seems like those were completely out of balance here.
They're out of balance, John, and I think there's a couple of points to make. First of all, cases like this, jails like this, really have raised public awareness nationally to the problem of mentally ill people in jail. So many people cycle through jails. There is so little care, adequate care for them. This is a big problem, but more people, I think, are aware of it today than, say, 5 years ago. But the other thing to say, even now, the problems inside that jail aren't fully solved. And so this story is emblematic of a problem inside a jail in Tulsa. But the problem of treatment of mentally ill people, whether it's in Tulsa or anywhere else, is a big problem nationally. And I think that's why this particular man has become such a symbol.
Ziva Brandstetter, it sounds like this case was one, even in your experience, that really was emotionally wrenching.
Yeah, like I said, I've been reporting about the death penalty in Oklahoma for quite some time, including witnessing the botched execution we had several years ago. And, you know, it's hard to compare these episodes, but Elliot Williams' death haunts me. You know, watching that video haunts me. And I, as a reporter, am, you know, determined to sort of get to the bottom of what is going on, provide the policymakers with the information that they need. One thing that's interesting is our county just passed a tax to fund what they call mental health pods at this jail. They basically used the fact that they'd had all these deaths of mentally ill prisoners as a way to get more funding. So they've constructed four new pods that don't have things where prisoners can hang themselves. They haven't mentioned any plan to increase staff. So, you know, that's a concerning pattern under the new sheriff who, you know, replaced the old indicted sheriff.
Well, we may be revisiting this facility, if not this story. Ziva Brandstetter, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Ziva Brandstetter is editor-in-chief of The Frontier, and Andrew Cohen is commentary editor at The Marshall Project and author of Case in Point. Andrew, thanks for your guidance on this case as well.
My pleasure.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. The first big decisions of the Trump 100 days are in the books. More to come. As we look at the news now, they include energy projects of very great interest here in Oklahoma, as well as trade, abortion, hiring freezes, except we learn on the Supreme Court, where Donald Trump says they're hiring. On the line with us is Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. That's a lot for one day.
It really is a lot, and the executive orders are racking up from the Oval Office now, as promised by Donald Trump on the campaign trail. A whole bunch of executive orders in the first two working days of this brand new White House. Today, the two big ones, the Dakota Access Pipeline and the Keystone XL Pipeline. You remember the controversies on both of those. Both of those controversial pipelines suspended by the Obama White House at various times. Both back on now, although it's unclear from the White House exactly how they're back on and when they'll be built. The Dakota Access Pipeline, especially suspended back in December, as we reported repeatedly on the show here, protests from the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe in North Dakota and many, many others who went up there to stop just, you know, the last 1,100 feet of that pipeline that was supposed to run underneath a part of the Missouri River that's dammed, so it's a lake now. They put a stop to that when the Obama administration Army Corps of Engineers said that they wouldn't allow the project to be completed. Well, Donald Trump says that's back on. And a wrinkle to this now, Donald Trump says in both of these cases, including Keystone XL Pipeline, which is a Trans-Canada project, that he wants them built with American steel. Now, he didn't specify how that's going to be done. He did tell reporters in the Oval Office that this will be subject to negotiation. Don't know if that's just spontaneous words from the president or whether he intends to hold these projects up to a further negotiation with Canadian firms. But that's what the president said.
Whatever their route and however they're built and whenever they're built, they will end up in Cushing, Oklahoma, where we just profiled is the center of all the pipelines in North America. So they're very happy about that here in Oklahoma. But what about trade? Two decisions on trade, both involving the Trans-Pacific Partnership and NAFTA.
Yeah, well, major decision in a way, at least rhetorically, on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Yesterday, the president signing an order basically removing the United States, giving notice to other countries that the United States was pulling out of the TPP. On a practical level, John, it doesn't mean anything. The TPP has been dead for 6 to 8 months. It never got ratification in the Senate or in Congress. It never passed because lawmakers knew which way the wind was blowing in this populist election that we just had. So in terms of some company or some country's trade policy, it doesn't change a thing, but it certainly gives Donald Trump the opportunity to fulfill yet another campaign promise. On NAFTA, a little bit murkier, newly minted White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer telling reporters yesterday that the president considers NAFTA up to renegotiation. He said if ministers and prime ministers from Canada and Mexico want to renegotiate the trade deal under the confines of NAFTA, that they'd be willing to do that. If they don't, he said, the president will pull us out of NAFTA. That's all to be written in the future, saying, of course, that has to be discussed with the prime minister of Canada, the president of Mexico, and others. So Trump hasn't made any moves on NAFTA yet, but says he's about to.
Well, we'll see how those negotiations could possibly go when we talk to someone who's familiar with the situation in just a moment. But let's talk about that Supreme Court nominee. That could happen quickly.
Oh, Donald Trump told reporters gathered in the Oval Office today that he's going to make a decision this week on a new nominee to the Supreme Court, that he'll announce it next week. He's huddling with Senate Republican leaders today to go over the advice and consent over that pick. So that decision is close to getting made, or so it seems, from the new president.
Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillig. Thanks so much, Todd.
You bet, John.
Let's get a little more context regarding these first steps of Trump on trade policy. Besides backing away from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the president talked about NAFTA on Sunday.
We will be meeting with the president of Mexico, who I know, and we're going to start some negotiations having to do with NAFTA. Anybody ever hear of NAFTA? I ran a campaign somewhat based on NAFTA.
Tongue-in-cheek there, the North American Free Trade Agreement was a central feature of the Trump campaign. President Trump says he will also meet with Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau to renegotiate NAFTA with our northern neighbor. Ian Lee is a professor of strategic management and international business at the Sprott School of Business at Carleton University in Ottawa, Canada. Is this a can of worms that the Canadians are enthusiastic about opening?
No, quite frankly, not. Canada is deeply integrated into the U.S. economy. We are one-tenth the size of the United States. The relationship is often being compared to a mouse sleeping with an elephant. When the elephant sneezes, the United States, the mouse catches a cold or sometimes pneumonia. So we're always hypersensitive and extremely concerned about our relationship with the United States because two-thirds of the totality of our trade with the world is with one country called the USA. And so anytime there's suggestions about changing the rules that maybe will reduce our access, we become very, very nervous.
And you and some other of your colleagues have written about the possible draconian and apocalyptic consequences of a Trump administration. But here's Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, after Trump won the election, sounding pretty calm about the whole thing. Listen.
The fact is, I think it's important that we be open to talking about trade deals like NAFTA or any other trade deal. I think people know that we need to continue to work to make sure that the benefits for Canadians, for workers, for our economy from trade deals around the world continue to accrue. And if the Americans want to talk about NAFTA, I'm more than happy to talk about it.
It sounds like he thinks there's something in it for him. How will these negotiations go, do you think?
I think that's the issue. And I was quoted as saying that the election of Mr. Trump, and this is in no sense any criticism of the American Democratic decision. That is, of course, their choice, sovereign nation. But I said that the election of Donald Trump represented an existential threat to Canada because of our dependence on the United States. At the same time, the paradox is, and Prime Minister Trudeau is tapping into that, it represents an existential opportunity. And the reason why is that when we negotiated NAFTA back in 1993, because free trade was so controversial in Canada, we had lived for over 100 years from the founding of our country behind high tariff barriers, protectionism. And so we threw that out the window and we said, no, we're going to go in all in a partnership with the United States. However, we excluded a lot of different areas and said, well, we won't put that in the free trade agreement. We won't put in procurement. We won't put in services. We won't put in energy. We won't put in dairy products or telecom. And so there is a potential, given that President Trump targeted Mexico, not Canada, he says that's the threat to the United States. There is an opportunity for us, if we go in with our eyes open and be supportive of negotiations, that we can perhaps come to a deal with the United States that will lead to an improved, enhanced, supercharged NAFTA, almost a NAFTA 2.0, that's going to be much better than the NAFTA of 1993.
But it sounds like a NAFTA 2.0, and this is what Trump is betting on, could be, yes, the result here, which would be the last thing that a lot of Trump's critics have imagined.
Well, it depends what that NAFTA 2.0 is. Just in the last 48 to 72 hours, a lot of people in Ottawa, the capital of Canada, are discussing the possibility of essentially throwing Mexico under the bus and saying to the United States, look, if your problem really is with Mexico, how about we just do a bilateral deal between you and us, between Canada and the United States? That's a possibility that could happen in these negotiations, simply because they have such a profound competitive advantage on wages vis-a-vis the United States and Canada.
Ian Lee is professor of strategic management and international business at the Sprott School of Business at Carleton University in Ottawa. Thanks so much, Ian.
Thanks very much, John.
As Americans have confronted this country's racial history in new ways over the past few years, part of the history being deemed relevant today is the brutal and basic question of slavery. How much is a human life worth in dollars and cents? It is a question that has lingered down through history, and it was what former First Lady Michelle Obama called attention to in her speech at the Democratic National Convention.
The story of generations of people who felt the lash of bondage, the shame of servitude, the sting of segregation, but who kept on striving and hoping and doing what needed to be done so that today I wake up every morning in a house that was built by slaves.
A first lady calculating her value to that crowd and thinking about the value, the literal value of those slaves that built the house she slept in, the White House. University of Texas historian Dinah Ramey Barry has spent the last decade studying the economic forces that have defined black and white relations in the United States. Her book, The Price for Their Pound of Flesh, The Value of the Enslaved from Womb to Grave in the Building of a Nation, is out today. Professor Barry joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you.
How hard was this to unpack in a way that's relevant today without just looking at, accounting sheets and old, slave auction documents that you can see in museums today?
One of the things that I wanted to do was try to make sure that enslaved people's voices were central to the conversation. And so as I was using plantation records and ledgers and books of those nature, I had to find ways to weave in what enslaved people said or thought or how they reacted to those very same scenes that other people were reporting.
So would enslaved people take pride in having a higher price or a lower price?
Actually, I was surprised, but no, that wasn't the case. They didn't really care about their market values. What they cared about was who they were sold to, or where they were going, or if a relative had already been sold away from them. They wanted to be purchased by a certain person so they could get closer to that family member. But they didn't really complain or worry about their high or low values. They felt like they had other values, a different set of values that were more important to them. And that is what I call their soul values.
And how would those soul values be expressed?
A lot of times I would argue that their soul values were expressed in forms of resistance, in the way that they reacted to enslavement, whether they stayed in slavery or self-liberated by running away. Some of them made it to Canada,
And when they arrived, they would say, this is a first-rate bargain, as opposed to the first-rate bargain of the price on their body. But running away and being able to work for themselves, live with their relatives, and work their own plot of land was a bargain for them. And they felt like that was a way, an expression of how they valued themselves.
What in this part of American history has really not been told and that you're bringing to light for the first time? And how does it inform what's going on today in America, do you think?
The first is that most people don't realize that enslaved people were sold before they were born. They were also sold after they died. And I think that's a piece of this story that has not really been talked about that much in very many history books. And to understand that valuation occurred before, you know, anticipating women's fertility, anticipating the health of their unborn children, and accounting for that in the records, and then also this sort of illegal clandestine market of cadavers that were sold to medical schools for anatomical research.
When you think about all of those features and the value of the unborn, how would a woman be evaluated in her fertility? I mean, would it literally be said, well, she'll probably have this many kids? Was it known who she would have children with, those kinds of things?
Yeah, sometimes planters deliberately forced or selected particular people to partner up, and I look at this as a form of non-consensual intercourse. But they might have handpicked someone who was a strong worker, who had physical capabilities that maybe other enslaved people didn't express, and they would force those two to be together. They also would look at women to see if they had already had children, if those children were doing well, if they were working well, and if a woman had given birth to a number of children and they survived to age five, they would kind of look at her as someone that they could look to as a breeding woman. And then that term, in that day, they would use the term breeding wench.
Did you imagine, as you were doing your research, how you would have responded to some of the conditions that the enslaved people had to endure?
It's easy for us, you know, today to look back and think, well, this is what I would have done, or this is how I would have escaped, or this is how I would have subverted the institution. But I think in that moment, it's just hard for us to really truly imagine, because there's so many other circumstances that I think are unimaginable to our lives today.
One of the things that's very compelling about this book, and you describe it as a kind of a principle that you used in developing this history, is that you wanted to use names whenever you could. You couldn't always make them characters because you didn't know that much about them, but you wanted to hold on to that name. Can you just repeat some of the names that you've brought to life in this book, just so that we can hear in the way that you hear it, how that name signifies them as people as opposed to bodies? Because I think that's the really the sacredness here that you've tried to bring to light.
Yeah. These are names that were not necessarily in history books up until recently. So there's Ponto, you know, a 40-year-old man who fights back at the auction block and argues with the auctioneer about how healthy he is. And he tells his audience that they're lying, that the auctioneer is lying, that he's not as healthy as they say he is. There's Celia, a slave who we know a little bit about from her court testimony, but she fought the sexual abuse from her owner. She had given birth to two children from him, and she finally fought back at some point, and she killed him. We also have Isaac, and Isaac is probably my favorite person in the entire manuscript. He was being executed for leading a revolution or trying to lead a rebellion. And while he was on the gallows and they were about to hang him, he jumped to his own death. And I describe that as him expressing his soul value. Rather than let somebody pull the latch, he chose to jump on his own terms.
We have to go, but there's so much to talk about here and think about. What period of history do you think we're entering now? What's going on now that so much of this history seems to be in play in a new way, in surprising ways, in ways that sometimes are hurtful, but possibly get us to a new understanding?
I think there's a lot of parallels to the past, and I think as we examine the past and face it, particularly the history of slavery in this country, I believe slavery is a stain on our flag. And I really do hope that these conversations and the education about the longer history of American history without taking out some of the more difficult periods, which slavery is one of them, I think we can come to better terms with who we are and where we want to go as we refashion this country.
Dinah Ramey Barry is the author of The Price for Their Pound of Flesh, The Value of the Enslaved from Womb to Grave in the Building of a Nation. She's a professor of history at the University of Texas at Austin. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.